So good afternoon, everybody, and to excuse me, I have to sit on the chair at the moment. I had an operation on my knee, so I'm recovering at the moment. So here's the format today, pretty much the same as on previous occasions. Does anybody want to hear a talk about anything in particular? Or just talk? Maybe I'll start off with relating a story that I told this morning in a Thai talk, and it's actually a scene extract from a book in which the spiritual life is compared with climbing up a mountain. It's quite a common analogy. And in this particular episode, one of the mountaineers gets up very high, gets caught in a blizzard, and is snowed in for 3 or 4 days without food, without water, and finally the snow stops, ceases, he crawls out from under the rock or wherever it is he was sheltering, and realizes he's totally exhausted, that even though the weather's letting up now, he hasn't got the energy to get down the mountain. And then at that moment, he sees a really old rat crawling out of its own hole. And he realizes the only way that he can see to getting down the mountain is to kill the rat and eat it and use the energy from that food to save his life. So he realizes apart from the fact it's not going to be very delicious, he realizes that it's unwholesome thing to do, but he doesn't feel he have any choice, and it's an old rat anyway, it's probably not going to live very much longer. And so he catches the rat, eats the rat, and has enough energy to get down the mountain to safety, and thinks that's the end of the story. But it's not, because that old rat has an important job to do, because unable to catch the healthy insects on top of the mountain, it eats the diseased ones that can't escape from it. And so eating the diseased insects, it prevents the disease from spreading amongst the insect population. Without the old rat, disease spreads throughout the insect population. All the insects die. And when all the insects die, then there's nothing to pollinate and fertilize the plants on the mountain. The plants die. The plants die. The soil erodes. And then there's a landslide, and half of the village at the foot of the mountain submerged, and many people lose their lives. So, as I was saying, this is not just meant to illustrate the ecological principles, but also spiritual principles. And the fact that the law of karma is so incredibly complex that the Buddha himself said that it's not possible to come to an intellectual understanding of all of its ramifications. It's beyond the capability of the human intellect. And the complexity of causes and conditions that come into play here are not only those in present life, but there are causes and conditions from previous lives which increases the complexity to a great degree. So what that means is that it's very difficult to recognize the workings of the law of karma in everyday life, that it's very difficult to give the appropriate value and weight to our actions. Some, sure, we've all had experience with certain actions we've taken, certain words that we've said that seemed quite inconsequential at the time, but went on to have quite serious consequences in our lives. Similarly, episodes, conversations that seemed really earth-shattering or possibly having lifelong consequences at the time seem to have just sort of faded away until now they seem almost dreamlike. So what that means, I think, a certain humility and care and attention to our actions, but also I think that there's a recognition that there are certain areas of life in which we don't as yet have, or perhaps will never have, the ability to be absolutely sure about. And so the question is, what kind of criteria should we use to decide on what's appropriate or inappropriate, and how to act, how to behave? The Buddha taught us to take the teachings of the Buddha as a refuge, with the recognition or the proviso, yes, we don't actually know for sure that that's the truth, but we take it as a working hypothesis, and we don't try to bargain or to weigh things up in a worldly way. I'm reminded of passage I read once that impressed me very much, from a biography of an American doctor whose name I can't remember now, who was volunteered to work in Haiti in very backward conditions, of course, and he would on a regular basis walk some 6 or 7 hours through the jungle to visit a small hamlet with 2 or 3 houses and families. So it's 6 or 7 hours there, 6 or 7 hours back. And he was criticized by other people in the aid community, and that it was sort of inefficient use of his time, that he was spending hours and hours and hours going to take care of just a very small number of people when there are so many more people so closer by that he could look after. And his reply to this was that if you think that walking 7 hours to treat 2 or 3 families is wasteful, then you're saying that some people's lives are more valuable than others. And I believe, he said, that this view that some people's lives are more valuable than others are at the root of nearly all of our problems in the world today. I thought that was a really profound thing to say, because, and I think I've spoken about it myself, the problems that arise when you even unconsciously take the view that the end justifies the means, or that you have to sacrifice certain number of people for the benefit of a larger number of people of whatever kind. So in Buddhism, as I understand it, and I think agrees with what this doctor, that the value of human life is incalculable, that you can't do those kinds of sums in that way, that you give an absolute value to all life. And as a monk, then, they would take that very seriously. And I as far as I remember, like 30 years, I don't think I've ever deliberately swatted a mosquito. And keeping that kind of standard of conduct gives you a great deal of self-confidence, self-respect. Makes me very happy just to consider the fact that I've lived in malarial swamps and jungles and lived with swarms of mosquitoes and never deliberately, I've accidentally, but never deliberately killed any of them. So that if we take that common sense point of view of the man on the mountain willing to kill the old rat, then it's not, they're not only ecological consequences, but all kinds of karmic consequences that we can't appreciate in a quantitative way. So taking the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha as a refuge, those the principles that they represent, gives us a kind of a map or a steadfast, stable reference point in our lives. And at the same time, we need to be constantly looking into the way that things relate to each other, the causes and conditions, even though we can't see the big picture. We can only see certain aspects of it. Then it can still help to give that enhanced sense of responsibility for our conduct and our behavior, which is so important. So in the practice of meditation, then we're seeking to develop a habit, a new habit of leading our lives. So it's not just a particular technique that we apply at certain times and certain places, but the idea is we're developing a new way of being, a new way of relating to our whole experience. So with the adoption of a meditation object, it means that we have an anchor for consciousness, or a screen by which we can see what's actually going on in our minds moment by moment, and being able to recognize mental phenomena as mental phenomena, thoughts as thoughts, feelings as feelings, so on. And we recognize a thought as a thought, and then gently but firmly put it down. And through constant, regular practice in this way, we gain an ability to do that in our daily life, which becomes more and more proficient, more and more giving us that feeling of having a refuge. But the practice of meditation in daily life and of mindfulness in daily life is one in which we're not merely aware of what we're doing, in the sense of I'm walking, I'm sitting, I'm reading, and so on. But it has to be within the light of the framework of kusala dhammas and akusala dhammas. So it's not just that I know I'm doing this, but knowing the quality of the mind, whether the mind is affected by greed, hatred, delusion, or is unaffected by it, whether the tone of the mind, the flavor of the mind is one which is leading to freedom or leading to bondage and away from liberation. So for that reason, there has to be a certain amount of intellectual groundwork and appreciation of Buddhist psychology, and also recognizing and being conscious of the different kinds of thoughts and emotions that arise. So in other words, we need to be able to know and to distinguish and to have a very sharp sensitivity to the negative emotions such as fear, anxiety, doubt, shame, embarrassment, guilt, anger, jealousy, and so on. And also to the positive emotions of kindness and generosity and compassion and patience and contentment and joy and bliss and so on. So we need to have that kind of intimate knowledge of those mental states, so that when we meet them, we don't have to be thinking, you know, what is this, or reacting towards the mental state with attachment or rejection. So just as a close member of your family or a friend should walk into the room, you don't have to be thinking, who is that, what's their name. You know immediately because you're so familiar with them. And that's the kind of familiarity that you need with the different mental states. So in the formal meditation practice, where your eyes are closed and you're putting aside all your regular duties, responsibilities, preoccupations, then you have a chance to see mental objects very, very clearly as they arise and pass away. But seeing them in that way is of importance, not just in the meditation session itself, but so that you really get to know those particular or those mental states. And observe also that every mental state has an accompanying particular physical counterpart, flavor, different emotions manifest in different parts of the body. And so I think we can say an emotion, you know, is physical sensation plus plus thought, plus imagery. And really to be able to deal effectively with emotion, you have to be able to develop that awareness of both sides of it, both the kind of the obsessive or even sometimes kind of crazy kind of thoughts that are distinctive to that emotion, but particularly the physical sensations. Because in daily life, if you have that kind of sensitivity, then you can catch it very quickly. For myself, I've noticed if I start to get irritable, it manifests in my calves. And so if I just get this tingling, just a little tingle in my calves, I know I'm getting irritable, and I can do something about it. So I don't yet have a kind of conscious sense. It's not that level of criticizing or commenting on people's behavior or conduct or personality. It's not got to that kind of verbal conscious level yet. It's pre-conscious. It's just it's already manifest as a tingle in my calves. You know, a friend of mine was kind of a joke in the monastery, because he'd get it in his hands, and you could always tell where he's irritated. He just his hands start moving, and so you know, every one of us is different, and for let's say it's very interesting and enjoyable actually to conduct this kind of study to see particular emotions. Not only the kinds of thinking, the sort of grooves, troughs that the mind habitually falls into, particular thoughts and trains of thought, but the physical sensations which accompany them. So that's the first part, the actual sense of the flavor, the essence, the lived subjective experience. Of both positive and negative emotions, but secondly, how they fit in to the framework of the threefold training or the noble eightfold path, or however you want to distinguish it. Meaning, you're aware not only is this tingling in your calves, for instance, a sign of approaching irritation, but that irritation is an unwholesome dhamma and is something which is founded upon a false, inaccurate perception. So negative emotions can only arise through ignorance and craving. That's the reason why that there's something that you can do about them, and that you don't have to be a prey to them your whole life. But as we try to look more closely, we begin to see the particular obstacles that arise in Buddhist terminology, the maras. And one of them is, I don't want to feel like this. And another one is, I shouldn't feel like this. So as soon as you latch onto and identify with those attitudes towards emotions, particularly obviously negative emotions, then you lose your ability to understand them and to let go of them. So a lot of the tension and the strife of negative emotions is the fight against them. You don't want them to be there. And the sort of common sense thing is something unpleasant arises, you get rid of it. And in certain areas of life, that's eminently sensible. But if you want to get rid of negative emotions immediately, you don't want to have anything to do with them, you don't want to have to put up with them, then you just give them energy, you feed them. And this is what we call the vipava tanha, the craving not to have, not to be. And, so, again, an example from my own life. Many, many years ago, I think I told you once, I did a year-long solitary retreat in a cave, and it was as near to sensory deprivation as you could get, as I could find. And the cave was pitch black, and I had some candles, and I would light a candle for about an hour a day, otherwise just living in the darkness. And I could tell dawn and dusk by the bats. The bats would go out at dusk and come in at dawn. So the bats were in a different part of the cave to where I lived, and they didn't bother me at all, and there wasn't a strong smell of bat droppings there. It was kind of a breeze coming through. So, but at some time, I can't remember exactly when, this small bat, baby bat, decided to hang just above my head, and so the roof of the cave. And I mean, poor thing. I mean, it didn't have any malicious intentions, and the objectively the disturbance caused by a baby bat coming in and out every now and again, just sort of stretching its wings or just sort of flapping its wings a little bit. Objectively, on a scale of 10, where would that be on the disturbance level? I mean, absolutely negligible. But it became a major issue in my life. Not having anything else to make a problem out of. And so I developed this really kind of nasty scheme just to make its life so uncomfortable it would go somewhere else. So I had this torch, and every now and again I'd just shine this torch at it so that it would be startled and think, this is just a miserable place to live. and this went on for some days, and I was getting more and more kind of fed up with this bat. And at one point I shone the torch. I didn't actually touch it or something, but something happened, and I turned off the torch, and then I heard this. And I looked down, and there was the bat on its back on the floor, like this. I thought, oh no, I've killed it. It's a terrible bad karma, and I can't. What am I going to do? I shouldn't have done that. I had incredible kind of guilt and remorse, and I felt absolutely terrible. And then about an hour later, it had gone. It hadn't died. It had flown away. And it didn't come back, so that was all right until I found something else to make a problem out of. But what I saw was, it wasn't so much the, as I say, the sound or the objective disturbance, because it was very little. But it was because I shouldn't have to put up with this. I've come hundreds of kilometers. I've made great sacrifices. To be in a completely black, still sensory deprivation environment, and this bat's coming along and spoiling it. So, I don't know about you, but I've noticed this. In in other areas of my life, that when there's some kind of reaction against something and suffering with it, it's not so much that the thing in itself is so terrible, but it what really rankles and rubs me up the wrong way, as you say in English, is the fact that but I shouldn't have to be putting up with this now. You know? When I was first at Wat Bapong in the late 70s, I'd come from England, and I was just so inspired to be able to live with Ajahn Chah. You know, thinking, wow, I'm 20 years old, and I'm a disciple of an Arahant. You know, and I just, how wonderful. You know, I'm just so fortunate. And Wat Bapong at that time, you know, was still thriving, and there were 60, 70 monks, at least that number of nuns, and very big community. And I just assumed that this kind of elite forest monastery with an incredibly austere and tough schedule would, just by its very nature, be weeded out, and just have really the cream of the cream, the people with absolute cast iron commitment. And finding it wasn't like that at all. And there were just some monks, you think, what are they doing here? I mean, how, you know, what's in it for them? You know, they're not interested in practice, and, you know, sometimes even like fist fights, and some of the novices in those days, forest monasteries, you'd have like a large number of teenage novices, and teenage novices, at least teenagers basically, you know, and getting up to all kinds of mischief. And if you're at the top of the line, you can more or less sort of shut your eyes to that. But if you're right down there in the middle of it, I just felt this incredible incongruity between the setting and the presence of the abbot and everything, which was so much, just a dream come true for myself, is exactly what I was looking for in my life. And yet, being surrounded by, a number of really mischievous teenage boys who are, you know, really kind of naughty sometimes. But again, as with the baby bat, I mean, the actual impingement on my daily life was really negligible. I didn't have to have that much to do with them. But it's the thing that they shouldn't be here. It shouldn't be like this. Wat Bapong should be absolutely impeccable. It should be the best monastery. It should have all the best monks. So again, it's this this sense of what should be and what shouldn't be as being sort of a major contribution to suffering, and takes you away from seeing what the situation really is. I mean, it's like this. It's just this way. It's not anything else. It's like this. And that kind of reflection was one that came to help me a great deal. You know, it's like this. It's just this way. And then, say, reflecting in terms of causes and conditions has always been very cooling to my mind. So yeah, there are naughty novices. Well, they're teenagers. A lot of them don't actually want to be here. They're here because they're so misbehaved that their parents and teachers have given up on them and just hope that somehow Ajahn Chah would sort them out. And that, you know, this is what you do with with delinquent teenagers in those days. You send them to the monasteries. Yeah, fair enough, you know. I'm thinking, well, if I was, if I'd been forced to go into a monastery when I was 13, 14, and have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and walk 5 or 6 kilometers for my food every day, and only eat one meal a day, and I probably would be looking for a bit of fun when I could as well. So that effort to understand why exactly is it like this, what are the causes and conditions, takes out, you know, a lot of the sting from circumstances. So whether you're looking at other people or looking at yourself, that for me is the most productive mode of inquiry. And when, for instance, if you're looking back at poor decisions you've made, or things that you regret now, then realizing, well, yes, in that particular time of my life, I had, you know, that much emotional, spiritual maturity. I had that much greed, hatred, and delusion. The external circumstances were like this. Given that everything was like that, that I was like that at that particular time, well, that was a natural result. So if you don't take this, your starting point as this independent entity, me, who has been foolish, successful, unsuccessful, has had all these experiences, has done this, has had this done to me. If you don't start off with that idea of somebody, meaning me, who's had this career, or is careered through experiences, then beginning to adopt a whole new mode, a whole new way of looking at experience, seeing things as a flow, without any one part, one element as fixed and unchanging, or as the subject or the actor behind all those experiences. And this is what we're trying to do in meditation, that, as I say, we're sort of recalibrating a whole way of experiencing ourselves and experiencing life without that instinctive rushing towards and grasping onto pleasant experience, or pushing away, rejecting unpleasant experience. Not saying that we should be a particular way, or that we should not be like this. You know, sometimes when we look at our thinking process very, very clearly, it's incredible. I think it's really sobering to what extent the amount of illogic there is. If you consider yourself basically kind of a logical, reasonable kind of person, which I think most of us do, the extent to which we don't think logically is quite a revelation. I don't know if anyone has read a marvelous book called The Year of Living Magically, Thinking Magically, I think it is. It's a book written by American author Joan Didion, and recounts the year following the sudden death of a heart attack of her husband after they'd been married for 40, 50 years. And so she's one of the leading intellectuals of the past 50 years in America, a very intelligent woman. And what she found was, over the period of this year, that she was thinking magically. She wasn't thinking in the kind of rational way that she'd assumed that she's thinking. So, for instance, even months after her husband died, she still couldn't bear to, I mean, it's this common phenomenon, couldn't bear to get rid of his shoes or some of his clothes. And then she just asked himself, well, why can't I do this? And she realized it's because, well, he may come back at any time. So in her mind at the same time, when she's, knows for sure, he's dead, he's not coming back. But the other part of her mind is, I can't get rid of these shoes. I can't give away these clothes, and just in case he might want them sometime. So she recounts many such examples of the way her thinking was. Those are kind of extreme examples. But I think in daily life we're absolutely completely bound up with contradictions, which, lacking that kind of interest and introspection, we don't really recognize. Sometimes we perhaps I've always been very inspired with this beautiful Thai phrase, which you may know is attaching gold behind the Buddha. Can you guess what the provenance of that? When you get these little squares of gold leaf and you attach them to Buddha images as a way of merit making. Most people want to put their little square right on the front of the Buddha, but some people put it on the back where it can't be seen. And so this has become an idiom, meaning when you do good but you don't want anybody else to know about it, you don't need to have your name in the papers or any kind of recognition. And that kind of what the Japanese I think calls like secret goodness, that's considered the most purifying kinds of wholesome actions. I think that I'm sure all of you have performed those kinds of actions. But what I think is kind of humorous and interesting is that sometimes you have developed some good quality or you've done some good action which you've deliberately concealed from others. And then you're with somebody, and then you realize this kind of there's this kind of funny discomfort and unpleasant feeling focused on this person you're with, and you realize that you're dissatisfied with them for not recognizing the goodness that you've tried to conceal from them. So it's like, I deliberately didn't tell that person, but they should somehow have intuited, they should have guessed, they should have recognized. So we have these kinds of unrealistic expectations and hopes in other people, and then sometimes get upset with people, not quite realizing that the cause often not in their own behavior, but because we have these unexamined assumptions or expectations or desires that they're not fulfilling for us. So I think one is very useful, important to let go of that idea of yourself as a rational thinking being, and recognizing that it's a lot more complex than that, that within your mental life there are certain rational habits and certain irrational habits. Because only when you have that kind of evenness of mind and readiness, willingness to accept that this is a possibility, then you can start tuning into those illogical thought patterns. And that's not that they're, as I say, bad in themselves, just with anything else, knowing them, then the opportunity, the possibility of you suffering as a result of them is much reduced. And you can also appreciate and forgive other people who act in illogical ways or ways you think illogical. So the refuge in daily life, as I say, first in precepts, because if you keep to the precepts as your ideals, as your standards in life, as your constant recollection, then even given the complexity of the law of karma, which I spoke about to begin with, you can feel safe. that you're never going to go too far off the tracks. But in a moment-by-moment basis, most importantly, is developing and caring for, nurturing this sense of knowing. And when you have developed that, the difference between the meditation and daily life becomes less and less obvious. You really feel like you're doing the same thing, even in quite busy environments or performing various kinds of responsibilities. Is what happens is that as various things impinge on your eyes, ears, nose, tongue, but as various thoughts, emotions arise, then there is a sense of knowing which arises like its shadow or almost simultaneously with the thought, with the feeling. And following that sense of knowing, often there can be various kinds of insight into impermanence, into suffering, into non-self, depending often on your personality or the area of teachings that you've focused on most particularly. But that sense of things arising together with the sense of knowing is the real, I think, mark of someone who's really developed meditation, to the extent that you're not just using it as a technique for relaxation or just to get away from yourself at regular intervals, but one in which it's playing an important part in strengthening and stabilizing this sense of knowing so that you can sustain it throughout the daily schedule that you have. So when there is that sense of knowing and alertness in the mind, then mind also starts to feel very, very bright and energetic and relaxed. So it's a relaxed alertness that is really probably the key characteristic. You know, in non-meditative states, these two things don't usually go together. The people can be very alert, but the alertness is fueled by testosterone or fueled by drugs or fueled by some kind of stimulus. So it's an alertness which is not relaxed. And when people are relaxed, they're usually not alert. So what we're developing in meditation, to say, is this fusion of harmony of relaxation and alertness. And that's something that needs to be developed right from the very first steps, being with your breath, being with your meditation object, to develop that balance and harmony of relaxation and alertness. And then from there, being able to carry that over into daily life, so that the sense of knowing is there all along. As things happen, you speak, you receive impressions, there's an awareness of causal relationships, relationship between body and mind, relationship between sounds, form sounds, and mental states, and so on. This very kind of complex operation that sounds quite daunting if it's explained in words. It's just something that starts to take place more or less spontaneously. But the what's really important is maintaining that real kind of interest in that, interest in what is this? What is this life? And that's one of the basic Zen koans. And I think that is in no way alien to Theravada tradition. You know, it's this constant even though if it's not asking a question as such, there's that really fundamental interest. What is this? What is this? What is this? That's the kind of attitude that we have in daily life outside of meditation. Okay, I think that will suffice for the Dhamma talk. And now we can have a period of meditation. Would you like to sit? Would you like to stretch your legs first? Do you want a 5-minute break? 5-minute.